It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have 2 more hours of this.
Maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Oh, another week, another Vince McMahon story. It just keeps getting worse. We've got yet another celebrity possibly on his way back to WWE. An update on Sasha Banks and Naomi. Angelo Dawkins is pissed off about everybody putting over Montez Ford and ignoring him. I've got health updates on Big E and Chris Jericho. Lots of Twitter drama. When is there not drama on Twitter? And even some New Japan and Stardom news. It's another busy week. This is episode 764 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, July 10th, 2022. You're going to hear me talking about this over the next several weeks, but House of Glory is making its debut at Terminal 5 in New York City next month, Sunday, August 28th. It's going to be our biggest event ever, high intensity. And on that night, the House of Black will be invading House of Glory. Malakai Black, Buddy Matthews, and Brody King, the same Brody King who not only just challenged Jon Moxley for the interim AEW world title on Dynamite, but I saw apparently put Darby Allin through a table, looked like at a Hot Topic or something in some mall. Imagine walking through the mall, you look over and you see Brody King putting Darby Allin through a table. That would be quite the sight to walk by and see. So all three of them are going to be coming to Terminal 5 next month. Tickets are on sale right now. It is going to be the biggest show that I've ever had the opportunity to commentate for, and I hope that you can join live at the venue or on pay-per-view. You'll be hearing me talk more about it over the next several weeks as the card comes together. I want to say thank you to a bunch of people who have supported via PayPal this week. You can do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button right at the top of the link tree. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. I want to say thank you to Ms. Madness, Michelle Mills. I know she's been diving into the This Week in History playlist I put together on the YouTube channel while she's been sick at home, passing the time with it. I'm glad that you are enjoying them, and I hope that you and your son are feeling much better, if not now, then very soon. So thank you to her. The Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker Nayef Al-Safar, Big B Brian Becerra, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Killshot Keith Hart, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, John Raging Mad Riffle, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, Caleb Showtime Lindley, Shin Superkick Akuma, our boy the Iowan Corn Farmer, Jesse Lampier, and the best, Christian Ortiz. Thank you all, and also thank you to the SoCal Saint, St. Clair Isuka, who runs a YouTube channel called Sainted Entertainment. You can check it out for wrestling, sports, other highlight videos on YouTube and Instagram. Just search for Sainted Entertainment, and it should come right up. So thank you to all of you. I very much appreciate all the support, but we got some news to get into here. There was another bombshell report from the Wall Street Journal this week regarding hush money payments made by one Vince McMahon to women who used to work for WWE, including now at least one former talent from the Diva Search era. This story just gets worse. We've gone from a $3 million agreement that was made earlier this year with a former paralegal to more than $12 million paid out to 4 different women, including the paralegal, over the past 16 years. That's what we know of, at least. You know, soon they're going to have enough women to put in a ladder match, they can call it hush money in the bank. Per the latest story, the payouts went to 4 women, all formerly affiliated with WWE, who signed agreements with McMahon that prohibit them from discussing potential legal claims against or their relationships with him. This is according to people familiar with the deal, all the deals, as well as documents reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. The previously unreported settlements include a $7.5 million pact with a former wrestler who alleged that McMahon coerced her into giving him oral sex and then demoted her and ultimately declined to renew her contract in 2005 after she resisted further sexual encounters. The wrestler and her attorney approached Mr. McMahon in 2018 and negotiated the payment in return for her silence. This is according to people familiar with the matter. In another previously unreported deal, a WWE contractor presented the company with unsolicited nude photos of McMahon that she reported receiving from him and alleged that he had sexually harassed her on the job, according to people familiar with the woman's 2008 non-disclosure agreement. McMahon agreed to pay her roughly $1 million. And in a 2006 agreement, a former manager who had worked 10 years for McMahon, I don't think, when they say manager, I don't think they mean wrestling manager. I think they're talking about somebody, kind of in an administrative position. But a former manager who worked 10 years for McMahon before he allegedly initiated a sexual relationship with her was paid $1 million to keep quiet about it. WWE's board of directors is investigating Mr. McMahon's agreement with the former paralegal and the 2018 deal with the former wrestler. Of course, McMahon isn't the only one under investigation here. Let us not forget that old Johnny Ace is part of this inquiry as well. The story mentions that the board is also investigating allegations that John Laurinaitis had a sexual relationship with the same former paralegal. The board is also looking at a $1.5 million non-disclosure agreement reached in 2012 with an employee involving misconduct claims against Laurinaitis, who had been the head of WWE talent relations for 8 years when he was forced to step down in 2012 and take a smaller role within the company. His demotion came around the same time as the payoff to the employee who alleged that she had an affair with Laurinaitis and that he demoted her after she broke it off. McMahon had restored Laurinaitis as head of talent relations last year, and WWE has since placed him on administrative leave. So they knew. Vince knew about the prior accusations against Laurinaitis and the money and the NDA. They demoted him, only to then reinstall him back into the same position years later. You know, they say birds of a feather flock together. Fightful spoke to people who believe Laurinaitis has himself a nice golden parachute. So if he does not come back, and I don't see how he ever does this time, then he's not going to have to come back because he'll be taken care of financially. But the Wall Street Journal could not determine whether the investigation includes the non-disclosure agreements involving the contractor and the former manager or how far back the probe will go. And as always, that is the key. How far back are they digging here? Because you know damn well we're only scratching the surface when it comes to the dirt on Vince McMahon. This guy has paid out more in hush money than he paid for all of WCW. WWE issued the following memo to their employees on Friday after the story broke. The Wall Street Journal has published a second story with expanded details on its initial report last month. We want to reiterate that we and our board of directors take these allegations seriously. We've been cooperating fully with the investigation led by our board of directors and will continue to do so until its conclusion. Please note that upon its conclusion, WWE leadership will make itself available to answer any questions that you may have. Oh, I have questions. You know, they still haven't said if the findings of the law firm that's investigating is even going to be made public. You would assume that, you know, to some extent, we will find out exactly what those findings are, but they've never, I don't believe, actually come out and said that. You know, what level of transparency, if any, is there even going to be at the end of all this? Nor have they said if they or the board makes any recommendation upon the conclusion of this investigation, if Vince McMahon is actually going to follow that recommendation. Right? Because just because they say he's cooperating fully doesn't mean that if they find he should step down, that he would actually do so. Coincidentally, we had a man this week by the name of Connor Schell. Now, you may have never heard of him before. I may have never heard of him before. I don't know who the fuck this guy is, other than He was on the WWE Board of Directors, and this week, Connor Schell resigned from his position on the WWE Board of Directors just 2 days before the Wall Street Journal story broke. Now, the reason given was an increased slate of responsibilities resulting from his expanded role at the newly formed The North Road Company, which is the company that he works for. He said that his quitting had nothing to do with any dispute or disagreement with the company, its management, or the board on any matter relating to WWE operations, policies, or practices. So that's what he says, but boy, you know, that timing sure is something, isn't it? How much more of this are they going to tolerate? How many other stories? How many other surprises? How many other NDAs? What's the number that has to be hit? What's the quota that has to be reached before they say, okay, this is ridiculous, enough is enough? I mean, I'm not expecting them to make any kind of public declaration or recommendation until the investigation is over. I'm just asking in general, at what point do we sort of reach that critical mass where it's like, okay, we've got to make a change here? Every story is a bigger black eye for the company than the one before it. Every story just gets worse and worse and makes him look even scummier than he already does. Now, wrestling is not exactly looked at in the best light to begin with, publicly, but it is a publicly traded company. They are trying to be more of a, you know, a company that does business with all these big sponsors and companies, right, and cleaned up its image from what it used to be. So if that's the kind of company they want to be, again, every single time there's a story like this that comes out, it's a bigger black eye for the company as a whole. Sean Ross Sapp on Fightful Select, he noted that multiple WWE staffers reacted to the news that McMahon paid off several other women to keep quiet about inappropriate sexual encounters by, perhaps out of frustration, sharing his true reaction. They finally came out and shared his reaction to the allegations after the first story broke all those weeks ago. Fightful was contacted by multiple WWE staff, including some who had remained quiet in the past about McMahon's handling of the situation. One told Fightful that they wished they had spoken out sooner and said that McMahon's response would often go from no-selling the entire thing to being defiant. And they said that after McMahon's pointless June 17th appearance on SmackDown, which was the day the first story broke, he returned to the gorilla position and shouted, "Fuck 'em!" Seemingly in response to the allegations that caused his entire insistence to even be on television in the first place. That's what got him into this mess in the first place. But that confirms what I said on that first podcast I did after the story broke. What did I say? I said the only reason Vince McMahon went out on television that Friday, and again that Monday, was to send a message. He had one purpose in making those appearances, and it was not to put over John Cena as the greatest of all time. That's not why he went out there. It wasn't for that. It wasn't because he thought that this might be some sort of farewell to the WWE universe. I don't know how this is going to end up. This is my way of saying goodbye. That's not what it was either. He did it because he wanted to make it clear to everybody that he wasn't going anywhere, and that he still runs this place. So he can step aside temporarily and let Stephanie take over as CEO, but it is still very much the Vince McMahon show. That was the only reason that he did that. Everything to him is a fight. It's in his personality. It's in his DNA. Everything is a fight. The U.S. government came after him and he fought back, right? You have to fight. WCW was beating him. He fought back. They started coming after the company when Linda was running for Senate in Connecticut. We end up with Vince on television asking the fans to stand up for WWE. Remember that whole campaign? He went on television asking fans to stand up for WWE. He went on Pat McAfee's show in March, only a few months ago, right before the first email came into the board of directors, and admitted that he tunes out any negativity, any kind of negative feedback on the internet to his creative ideas, you know, all of it. He tunes out all of it and pays no attention to any of it. his natural instinct with everything, including the fans and anybody who disagrees with him, is to say, fuck him. And to fight back. Only this time, he may have dug his own grave, and it's a hole so big that he can't climb out of. The impact of all of this is already being felt with the news from Denise Salcedo that Netflix has quietly dropped its planned documentary series on Vince McMahon, which was just about wrapped up. That was a big deal when they first announced it, and the company was cooperating, and they were filming stuff for it, and it was almost done. Yeah, it's not as if they hadn't started filming yet. They were deep into it, and according to her sources, they have pulled the plug on the project. She tweeted, "Sources tell me that the Vince McMahon Netflix documentary has been pulled and is off the programming spreadsheet at Netflix. A source at Netflix confirmed it is no longer being listed on their spreadsheet. Another source said that shit's out of here." Another person indicated that the project was already deep into post-production and that several talent interviews had been done months ago and millions of dollars were spent. I spoke to one of the producers on the project, however, they declined to confirm or deny this story to me. For the past couple of days, people on social media have been playing Private Eye, trying to figure out the name of the diva that Vince paid the $7.5 million to. It was a woman who got a push and then was demoted, and then ultimately let go when her contract expired. It's not that hard to try to figure out who it is, if that's the sort of thing you want to do. I'm not going to partake in any of that, nor am I going to throw out any possible names, because it doesn't matter who it is. If this person wants to come forward publicly and tell her story or break her NDA or whatever, then that's what she'll do. And without knowing for sure 100% who it is, it would be irresponsible to throw out random names anyway, and then you end up naming people who may have absolutely nothing to do with any of this, and don't want to have anything to do with any of this. So I'm not going to do that. The bigger issue here is what Vince McMahon is accused of doing. This person claims that she was coerced into giving him oral sex. That's very similar to the Rita Chatterton story. Remember, Rita Chatterton accused him of exactly the same thing, and that was decades ago. But then there's the contractor who not only claimed that he sexually harassed her on the job, but actually presented the company with nude photos of him, which she claims were unsolicited nude photographs that he sent to her. People have been saying, oh, well, what if what Vince did was so bad, then why did the wrestler wait 13 years to go get money out of him? Or why didn't she just run to the cops if it was something that she was forced into doing that she didn't want to do? Or, what's the big deal if he paid with his own money and not company funds, then what's the problem? What's the big deal that he had a consensual relationship with the paralegal? They're two consenting adults. I am blown away by how many people have jumped to this man's defense with some of the absolute worst takes that I have ever seen. I said on the SmackDown post show, I don't know if it's a case where social media has made people dumber or if they were already this stupid and social media just gave them a platform for the rest of us to see it. I tend to think it's a little bit of both. But let's break this down. WWE and Jerry McDevitt, they're the ones who claim that the relationship with the paralegal was consensual. It may have been, but that is the company's version of it. We have not actually heard from the woman herself. Only a friend of hers leaked this to the board, which is what got the ball rolling on this entire thing. That her friend was scared and she just felt the need to come forward. She was so concerned about what the friend had told her that she saw fit to email the board of directors about this. So let's not assume anything was consensual just because the company said that it was. That's why there's an ongoing investigation. Innocent until proven guilty. I've heard this thrown around a lot this week, too. Unless he's charged with a crime or he's convicted of a crime, these people, they stand with Vince, like he's their buddy. This is not an episode of Law and Order. Vince McMahon is not on trial. Even if crimes were committed, it's not as if they're going to slap the cuffs on and throw an orange jumpsuit on him. I mean, we are talking about allegations of sexual misconduct, but I doubt this ever becomes any sort of legal issue for him. We're not talking about Vince going to prison. This is not the government coming after him in 94 where they're going to throw him in the slammer for 10 years. That's not what we're talking about here. What we are talking about is mounting evidence of an executive, the chief executive of a company who has doled out millions of dollars to keep these women quiet for a reason. He is buying their silence for a reason, and he is accused of abusing his power. That is what this is about. This is an abuse of power. A man who allegedly took advantage of his position. You can argue all you want until you're blue in the face that if the women went along with it, then how is it his fault? If it turns out that it was a consensual relationship, what's the problem? The problem is that even if the other person chose of her own free will to engage in a relationship with her boss, Vince McMahon, he is the boss. He is the emperor of WWE. Nobody gets pushed without him wanting them to get a push. Nobody gets television time without him wanting to get television time for that person. Nobody is given a championship without him wanting them to have a championship and to be one of the faces of his company. Do you see the picture I'm painting here? If somebody wants a raise, they don't get one without him approving it because he's the one who signs the checks. So if he had the hots for one of the divas, and I'm sure he had the hots for all of them, even got to work with some of them on TV. If he had the hots for one of the divas, and we know why, now we know why he had Johnny Ace picking people out of swimsuit catalogs, that makes it even more fucking disgusting. But you will only go so far in that company as far as he wants you to go. So if he came on to any of these women, or if he wanted to have sex with them, or he wanted to start a relationship with them, you don't think that these women didn't feel any pressure to say yes? Even possibly feel pressure to say yes for fear of losing their job, losing their spot, losing their push if they were getting a push? You know, you have to consider the time period as well. This was 2005. There was no WCW anymore. TNA was still in its infancy. They were 3 years in. They weren't nearly as big as AEW is after their first 3 years. There was no AEW back then. If you wanted to work for a major wrestling promotion and be on worldwide television to become a star and make the most money, there was only one person to work for. And that's Vince McMahon. And if you can't see what's wrong with that, then you must have a thick skull because there's no getting through to you. That's the real issue here. According to Fightful, it was a running joke in the writer's room. One former writer they spoke to said that Vince's relationships would be a half-joking excuse as to why he was late to meetings before TV. It's not as if people didn't suspect or know what was going on. What he did was wrong. Plain and simple. Were it not for this email to the board, he might have gotten away with it without us even knowing about it. Even his own lawyer, arguing that it was all consensual, is an admission that there was something going on. And in my opinion, that's all the board needs to know to recommend this guy's immediate and full resignation. The time has come. It has been long overdue. Vince McMahon, for the good of his own company, needs to resign from WWE. Right now, he has temporarily stepped aside while the investigation continues. He is no longer, at this exact moment, he is no longer the chairman and CEO. I think the belief is that when this is over, he'll be right back in the chair. And even now, he's still head of creative. He's still at every show. He's running things like business as usual. Vince McMahon needs to resign from all of his duties in WWE. Not just as chairman and CEO, but creative too. All of it. He needs to be gone. Now, that's not going to be easy, because his shares in the company still afford him more voting power than anybody else. I mean, it's ridiculous how much voting power he has. If he doesn't want to go, it's going to be very difficult to force him out. But the board can put pressure on him to step down. Sponsors and network partners can put pressure on him to step down for the good of the company. How many more of these stories are going to leak before one of these companies washes their hands of them altogether and says, you know what, these are not the kind of people that we want to be doing business with? They've worked so hard. They've tried to work so hard. They brought in Nick Khan. They did all these things. They made all these moves to improve the image of their company, right, and become a classier company. And it's all just going to get flushed right down the fucking toilet because it's only going to get worse. At what point does him still being there start to have a negative effect on business? At what point does he start to become a liability to this company? It hasn't happened yet. The stock price is stabilized. But they've also got two very important television deals coming up for renewal at the end of next year. One of those partners that they're working with, one of those partners they got $1 billion from, is Fox. Roger Ailes used to be the head of Fox News. He too had allegations of sexual harassment and sexual misconduct levied against him. Right? One of his former anchors actually filed a lawsuit against him for sexual harassment. She said she was fired for turning down his advances. And that led to more than a dozen other employees to come forward to tell their stories. This guy was one of the most powerful men in all of media. He was far more powerful than Vince McMahon has ever been in his entire life. He was defiant, but then when the company did their internal review, and all of a sudden that internal review expanded to other aspects of his time working there, his bosses saw this and said, you know what, it's time for him to go. And they gave him an ultimatum, resign or be fired. Now that's a little bit different because Ailes answered to his own boss. Vince is the boss. It's his company. That's the big difference. But if he really cared about his company, then he would walk away and spare it any further embarrassment. You know, there's lots of reasons for him to step aside. This, honestly, what I'm about to mention here isn't even really important compared to all this other stuff. I watched that SmackDown show on Friday night. SmackDown was an abysmal show this week. Shouldn't come as a surprise. According to PW Insider, that was 100% Vince McMahon's creative vision for what he wanted that show to be. We had a whopping 13 minutes of wrestling on a two-hour show. At least if the non-wrestling stuff was entertaining, I could excuse it, but it wasn't. This company has long needed a creative cleanse. And that just isn't going to happen so long as Mr. Happy Pants is running creative. It's not going to happen. Nothing is going to change. But the creative issue is one of many reasons why he needs to go. There was a very telling line at the end of the USA Today article on Friday because everybody covered this. I mean, the Wall Street Journal broke the story, but you know, it's the Wall Street Journal, right? So all of these media outlets are picking up this story. AP, Reuters, USA Today, The New York Times, all of it. USA Today, at the end of their article on Friday, they had a line in there that said this. WWE has admitted to investors that the success of the company hinges on McMahon's standing as its leader. Now, I don't know where and when they admitted that. A lot of publicly traded companies would say that losing their chairman and CEO would be a big risk. But a lot of people have parroted this line that, oh, without Vince McMahon, this company's going to be in a lot of trouble. As if the company, which has guaranteed money coming out of every fucking orifice, is somehow going to shrivel up and die without Vince McMahon. I got news for you. The man is 76 years old. He ain't going to be around forever. If you're a shareholder, that does not sound like something that would inspire a lot of confidence. That the success of this billion-dollar business rests on the shoulders of one man, who happens to be 76 years old. That sounds like something Vince McMahon would say. This company can't survive without me. I wouldn't be surprised if he's the one feeding that line to people. I'm sure he wants people to think that because the more people who believe it, the more likely it is they turn a blind eye to all the shit that he does. WWE would still make money hand over fist and do just fine without Vince McMahon. They are not going to die. They are not going to, you know, it's not going to be some epic collapse. They're big enough that they're going to do just fine. Vince McMahon will go down as the greatest wrestling promoter of all time, which is funny, seeing as how he doesn't seem to be such a big fan of actual wrestling. But he is the most successful wrestling promoter of all time, bar none. He took a company on the brink of bankruptcy. He turned it into a $1 billion business. He had a lot of help along the way from all the talent that worked for him. But he can hang his hat on that. That is part of his legacy. Nobody can take that away from him. But this is now part of his legacy too. And it's only going to get worse. People like Vince McMahon and John Laurinaitis have no business being in positions of power. They abused that power. And now they need to go. Tyson Fury, the Gypsy King, one of the all-time great heavyweights in the boxing world. He just retired from the sport. Now is said to be in talks with WWE for a potential return later this summer. This is according to a story on the website Give Me Sport. The site has been told that nothing is finalized at this stage, but discussions have taken place. Fury himself said months ago that he wanted to be at SummerSlam and Clash at the Castle in September in Cardiff. SummerSlam looks to be a no-go. It's too late in the game, I think, for that. So I assume this would be for Clash at the Castle. And the website says that they haven't been told if this would be just for an in-ring appearance on the show or an actual match in the ring. He and Drew McIntyre have been teasing a match for, it feels like, years. I think at least the last couple of years. They've been making comments in interviews and on social media about wanting to work with each other. And Tyson Fury, he wants a match with Drew McIntyre. And McIntyre says, bring it, because of course, he wants a match with him. So they've been teasing that for a long time, but McIntyre is likely going to be challenging Roman Reigns on that show for the championship. So if they do bring in Tyson Fury for an appearance, I could see him being either a special referee for that match or a special enforcer. Because he and Drew have, again, played up wanting to fight each other. You have that story of, is Fury going to do something to screw McIntyre out of the title? But then in the end, he beats up the bloodline or something to keep them out of the match, and McIntyre wins the championship, and then he and Fury celebrate in the ring together after and have a big moment to close out the show. Absolutely, I could see that. If they bring him in to wrestle somebody else, I don't know who that would be. You know, the one match that Tyson Fury had with Braun Strowman 3 years ago at Crown Jewel sucked. It was a terrible match. And it left me with no desire to see him in the ring again. Now, I'm not a big boxing fan, so maybe I don't get the appeal of Tyson Fury. I know he was a big attraction. He was a very successful fighter. I'm not denying that he has star power. I don't know that he was the kind of pay-per-view draw that a Mike Tyson or a Floyd Mayweather was, but, you know, no doubt, he was an attraction. He had a big name. But the bar has been raised when it comes to these celebrity matches. We've had some damn good ones. He was not one of them. I'm not sure what other opponent they might have in mind for him, but there's another celebrity that WWE just signed to a contract whose family has a history with the Fury family that could be a potential opponent for him, and that is Logan Paul. Dave Meltzer talked about the possibility of a Logan Paul-Tyson Fury match in this week's Observer, and I yawned so hard when I read that I almost dislocated my jaw. Logan's brother, Jake Paul, was, like him, also a YouTuber. He became a professional boxer a few years ago, and he has done well. And I know people would say, oh, yeah, he hasn't faced any of the elite, you know, boxers or whatever. The guy can fight. I think he has surprised a lot of people. He's done well for himself. He's made a lot of money. Fury's brother, Tommy, has pulled out of two scheduled fights with Jake Paul, one last year due to a medical issue, and then one just recently due to what he claimed were travel issues, some kind of visa issue. But it has turned into a whole thing. The two were supposed to fight next month in Madison Square Garden before Tommy pulled out. Now Jake Paul is fighting somebody else at MSG. But he's also threatening to sue Fury. I guess it was Jake Paul who booked the date at MSG, and then this guy pulled out. Now he's threatening to sue him because Fury's own father claimed in an interview that his son weighs 230 pounds. Which means he would have to drop 30 pounds in a month to be able to make the weight limit for the fight. So it looks like he only pulled out because he's overweight. Anyway, Tyson Fury has expressed an interest in doing a match with Logan Paul, but WWE would probably have to pay him huge money, pay him through the nose, to agree to the match. Hey, I'm sure Vince McMahon could just dip into his personal hush money fund if he really wants to make the match happen. You hear about slush money funds in businesses. He's got his own hush money fund. It's under his mattress. I'm sure if he dips in there, he can make the match happen. So the idea is that because the brothers have a beef, there could be money in a match between these two. it would get the company publicity, but honestly, I could not possibly care any less about any of this. And it goes to the heart of what I was talking about last week when I talked about Logan Paul being signed to a contract. He had a great showing at WrestleMania this year. He showed more of an aptitude for this than Tyson Fury did. And I understand WWE wanting to bring him back, but the idea of doing a match with two celebrities against each other and completely cutting out any actual WWE stars, it just makes it look like they're branching out into a real-life version of Celebrity Deathmatch instead of trying to make their own new stars. You know, normally at WrestleMania, if you had any celebrity involvement, it was one person, and usually to give one of their own stars the rub. This year, we had three. Logan Paul, Pat McAfee, and Johnny Knoxville. And they all did well, but it's overkill. You know, the idea of them doing Tyson Fury against Logan Paul, and it's just an idea. There's no indication the match has even been discussed. But the idea of this, all you're doing is bringing in these outside stars. It's like they're living out their dream of being in wrestling fantasy camp. And meanwhile, your own talent gets nothing out of this. I mean, now that I've said that out loud, I much prefer them using Fury as a referee or an enforcer for a Roman Reigns-Drew McIntyre match, especially if the idea is that McIntyre is going to be the one to beat Roman Reigns. And again, some people would say it should be Cody Rhodes, and I might agree with you on that, but I don't know. I don't know that Roman Reigns is getting out of Clash at the Castle without losing at least one of those titles, but Fury raising McIntyre's hand after he wins the championship, that would at least be a way to put over their champion, just like the way they use Mike Tyson with Steve Austin at the end of WrestleMania. It has been 55 days and counting since Sasha Banks and Naomi placed their women's tag team title belts on Johnny Ace's desk and walked out of Monday Night Raw. And there is still no confirmation that either woman has been released by the company, but there was an update this week from PW Insider that they are no longer considered active members of the WWE roster. Both of them were removed from the company's internal roster listing, even though their public profiles, I think, are still up on WWE.com. But that doesn't necessarily mean anything. But two signs that Sasha, at least, may have gotten her release are that there have been rumblings that she may be doing some signings this fall outside of WWE. And also, she has been removed as a profile icon option for Peacock subscribers. You know, before you had the option of Roman Reigns, Sasha Banks, and Asuka. Now they only have, the only WWE options now are Roman Reigns and Asuka. I don't use either one of them. On Peacock, you could pick a whole bunch of them. I have Michael Myers as mine. Once they added Halloween Kills to Peacock, they put up a profile icon for Michael Myers. That's my photo. But Sasha Banks is gone. You know, WWE has been taking steps to erase both women from existence, especially Sasha. The Peacock thing, that's just the latest little minor thing. But it's been reported that Sasha's lawyers have been working to secure her release. God, when I say that, that makes it sound like she's being held hostage in some foreign country. But Andrew Zarian of the Mat Men podcast said the same thing, that as recently as late last week, they were trying to get her out of her contract. Naomi leaving would surprise me. I said that the other day. If we come to find out that both women are gone, including Naomi, that would surprise me more than Sasha leaving. But Naomi did post an interesting message on her Instagram yesterday that got people talking. She said, it's a quote that she posted, "The moment you put a stop to people taking advantage of you and disrespecting you is when they define you as difficult, selfish, or crazy. Manipulators hate boundaries." That doesn't sound like somebody who plans on sticking around. But who knows? It could also be something else that's going on in her personal life. I mean, who knows? Anytime someone posts these cryptic messages, everybody tries to decode it. It literally could mean anything. But it is interesting because the rumor, if you remember, was that Naomi had a couple of months left on her current contract and she had been in negotiations on a new deal when all of this drama went down back in May. Well, that was in May. Here we are 2 months later. It's July. if that rumor was true, we're right around the time that her deal would be coming up for expiration. So I definitely think there's smoke to the fire when it comes to Naomi leaving. Sasha Banks is as good as gone. If she isn't already released, then she's as good as gone. If she wants to keep wrestling, and she will. I know a lot of people are wondering, maybe she won't even do wrestling anymore. You can't go higher than the main event of WrestleMania. What else is she going to do? She's going to get into movies and TV shows, and she did The Mandalorian. Everyone talks about The Mandalorian. What else has she done? Let's cool our jets and pump the brakes a little bit on assuming that she's got some TV career just waiting for her. Maybe she does. But that's literally the only major thing outside of WWE that she's done. And I don't even know, did they even bring her back for another season? I don't think they did, but she will absolutely wrestle again. There is not a chance in hell she wants her career to end like this. So she will be back in the ring. And if she's going to be back in the ring and she gets her release, there's only one other place that makes sense. And that is AEW. Could she work some matches in Japan? Yes, of course she could. But she is not going to sign a contract with a Japanese promotion. She is not going to sign a contract with an Impact Wrestling. If she wants to be on television, and she wants to make comparable money, the only person that she should be talking to is Tony Khan. I know she's already following him on social media. Tony Khan is the only person that she needs to be talking to. And she can be a difference maker in that AEW women's division, but only to the extent that Tony Khan allows her to be. It all comes down to the booking. It always comes down to the booking. The AEW women's division, the presentation of the division, it's still very much a work in progress. They have names like Thunder Rosa and Toni Storm and Britt Baker. They signed Athena. They have Chris Statlander. They're giving the God push to Jade Cargill, who could be a gigantic star. But Sasha Banks would be Tony Khan's biggest female signing. And honestly, not only would Sasha Banks be his biggest female signing, Sasha Banks would be one of his biggest signings, period. I'm not saying I would put her above CM Punk and Bryan Danielson, but on a list where you put names like Punk and Danielson and Adam Cole, Sasha Banks is going to be up there somewhere in that mix on that list. She would be a major signing for this company. This is a woman who is not just another WWE signing. This is a woman who headlined a WrestleMania. This woman is a star. She could be a license to print money just with merchandising alone. Once she is free, Tony Khan better have her on speed dial. Now, I still question, this is the issue I raised when she first walked out. I was saying this exact thing. I questioned how happy that she would be if, let's say, in 6 months after signing, she's in the position that someone like Ruby Soho is in right now. I can't imagine she would be too thrilled about that. There's always the risk that she does to Tony Khan what she did to Vince McMahon. But I think it's a risk that is worth taking. I think as long as he is honest about how he plans to use her, and he uses her to give that division a real boost and, you know, more airtime or whatever it might be, because she does have that cachet of having been on WWE television for so many years, and we know she's got a huge fan base. We would see very quickly how big that fan base really is and how loyal they are to her. But if they can use her in that way, when I say that she could be a game changer for that division, I'm well aware of the fact that they have signed a lot of women and here we are, and it doesn't feel like a whole lot has changed. I watch the shows. You don't have to tell me. I'm aware of that. But when I say that about Sasha, that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. It's not just about her getting a push. It's about what she could mean to the rest of the company, the rest of the division, and how it's used, and how much airtime they get. If Tony Khan can sign Sasha Banks, she gets more TV time. It makes the other women want to step up their game, too, and it could lead to more opportunities for them as well. And you know what? The more I think about this, because I do feel like Naomi is kind of getting slighted in all this, Sasha is the bigger star than Naomi is. I'm sorry, you know, Naomi stands. That's just the way it is. Sasha has been, you know, you look at her body of work and some of the things that she has done in her time in WWE, even going back to how she was used in NXT, she's always been a bigger star than Naomi. But the more that I think about this, if Naomi does leave, if they let her go, or again, if her contract expires and she just sort of quietly goes away, and it's not just Sasha that leaves, but Naomi also gets to leave the company, I would consider bringing them both in and debuting them together. And the long-term play for Sasha Banks is not to be in a team or a duo, but it was a very big story when they walked out. And kind of like the MJF thing, which was a very big deal when that happened, there's a lot of interest and a lot of people talking about that. It has died down a little bit because they've been out of sight, out of mind. Nobody knows what the hell's going on with MJF. And we still don't know what the official status is for Sasha and Naomi. So they've been gone for 2 months or almost 2 months now. Things have died down a little bit, but it was still a big deal. And people are still wondering, where are they going to land? What's going to happen with Sasha Banks? What's going to happen with Naomi? You know, again, the fans are well aware of what's going on. I would have them, you know, walk out there on Dynamite together. There's Mercedes and Trinity. You debut them the way the WCW would have debuted them back in the day. I'm not saying they're Hall and Nash, but, you know, kind of a similar thing where maybe they just show up unannounced on a live Dynamite one night, tickets in their hands, sitting in the front row. They don't say a word. They're just there to watch the show. That's one way you could get people talking. You'll notice, by the way, I have to point this out too. All the talk about doing a tournament to crown a new women's tag team champions right after the two of them walked out, they had Michael Cole on SmackDown make that announcement. That was 2 months ago almost. There has not been a peep about the women's tag team belts in almost 2 months. Or this phantom tournament that they spoke of. Nor have they made the effort to establish or call up any new teams. You would think in preparation for such a thing, they would start actually building some real women's teams. They have done none of that. They have done none of that. Which is just, it just goes to show you the WWE doesn't give a fuck about the women's tag team titles, nor did they ever really give a fuck about the women's tag team titles, which is how we ended up in this mess in the first place. So here's what I say. Put them in a glass case, and one day we can all tell our kids that those were the belts that the Jumping Bomb Angels once held. And we can just pretend that this era never even happened. Now let me break here for a minute and talk about this, because this is important stuff. People have all sorts of reasons for using a VPN. You know that I've been using ExpressVPN for some time now. I've talked about it a lot. I use it mainly for security reasons. But I know a lot of you have used it to save money on wrestling shows by spoofing your location, because a lot of these pay-per-views end up being cheaper outside the US. But there's also people who don't use ExpressVPN who browse online and end up having their identity stolen or important data of theirs collected right under their nose by these data brokers without even knowing it. And that data then gets sold to other people. To mask my digital footprints, I protect myself with ExpressVPN. One of the easiest ways these brokers tie your data back to you is through your device's unique IP address, which can also tell them about your location. When you're connected to ExpressVPN, your IP address is hidden. That makes it a hell of a lot more difficult for these brokers to identify who you are. ExpressVPN also encrypts 100% of your network traffic, which helps keep your data safe from hackers when you're on a public Wi-Fi network, for example. This is why I have ExpressVPN installed on my laptop and on my phone. You could even download it to your home Wi-Fi router. All I do is tap one button to turn it on, and I'm protected. You don't have to be David Copperfield. There's no magic trick involved. So make sure your online activity and data is protected with the best VPN money can buy. Visit expressvpn.com/solomonster right now and get 3 extra months free through my special link. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster. Visit expressvpn.com/solomonster to learn more. We got a health update this week from Big E. There was good news as far as how he's feeling, and not so good news if you are hoping to ever see him back in the ring again. In a 4th of July tweet, he said, "Update, my C1 isn't ossifying or forming bone quite yet. The current plan is to get more scans at the 1 year mark and see how it is progressing. The great news is I feel tremendous and surgery is off the table." It was in March that he got dropped on his head by Ridge Holland and had his neck broken. He's very lucky to be alive and not to be paralyzed. C1 injuries can be fatal. They're very scary. And from that same night, when we saw him that very same night. We saw him post that video of himself in the hospital. Ever since that night, he has kept a positive attitude. I think if the world had even half the positivity, just in general, that this guy has, it would be a better place. But I also thought this guy may never wrestle again. That's how I felt at that time. It was a very serious injury. And if he doesn't, I'm at least glad that he was able to call himself WWE champion. At least he got that money in the bank moment and he got to cash in. And not everybody gets to call themselves the champion. And again, his run was not a great run. And I don't even put the blame on him for that. Again, what did I say earlier when I was talking about Sasha and Tony Khan? It all comes down to the booking. But at least he was able to have that moment. Based on what he's saying here, we know that they won't even take scans. They won't even look until next March. That would be 1 year since the injury. And even then, there's no guarantee it'll be healing the way that they're hoping. Evidently, right now, it isn't, you know, healing the way that they want it to be healing even now. But he's out of the neck brace. And it's great that he doesn't have to go under the knife, but I would be very surprised to see him resume a full-time career after this. You know, right now that isn't even really important. I'm just happy to see that he's feeling good. He's able to live an otherwise normal life. He's out and about. Because somebody without the musculature that he has, if they get dropped on their head the way that he did, I don't think they're able to walk around on their own 2 feet ever again. All things considered, he's a very lucky man. Chris Jericho opened up on his podcast this week about the pulmonary embolism that he suffered last year when he was on tour with Fozzy in Europe. If you remember, back in December, he had some kind of medical issue that landed him in the hospital, and he was forced to miss some shows. We didn't know what the problem was, but he spoke about it at length for the first time, and it was pretty scary stuff. So for those who don't know, a pulmonary embolism, it's a blood clot that forms, usually in the leg, and it travels up to a person's lungs, and it then blocks one of the main arteries. He was first starting to notice symptoms when he was on stage. It was an event in Newcastle. And he's on stage, and he noticed he was short of breath, and he was gasping for air to the point where he couldn't get through all the lyrics to the songs. So he called his doctor back home, told him that it could be blood clots and that they would do scans to find out when he got back to the States. But when the same thing happened after another show, his doctor told him to get to the hospital right away. He didn't take the doctor's advice, and he kept performing until finally he had a doctor visit him in his hotel in London. And the doctor did some tests, and he confirmed that he had blood clots. And again, he was told, basically, get your ass to the ER. So he gets to the hospital. He could barely walk. He says it was a struggle just to be in the lobby and walk from one end of the room to the other. All of a sudden, it's like he would take three steps and he would be huffing and puffing and his heart was pounding like he just ran 5 miles. And he said it was terrifying. And they did a CT scan and it showed that his lungs were filled with blood clots. And he was adamant about not using a wheelchair and not wearing a hospital gown. He fought them on that. They wanted him to wear the gown. He said no. To be fair, I hate wearing those gowns too. I at least wore my underwear when I had to wear them. I was not doing it any other way. You're not going to catch me walking around with my bare ass hanging out the back of one of those things. But he said he didn't want to wear it because the minute that he did, in his mind, it would feel like more of a permanent stay. And he didn't like that. So they put him on blood thinners, but his oxygen level continued to go down, so they put him on oxygen. When they wouldn't let him leave the hospital, that's when we got those announcements that Fozzy had canceled their remaining shows. Even after he got home, he wasn't allowed to wrestle because of the blood thinners that he was on, and his doctor told him he needed to also lose some weight. So I'm sure you remember how bloated Jericho looked last year. He was starting to look like Fat Elvis. He revealed that he was 241 pounds, but he claims that he was never out of shape cardio-wise. He was never blown up in a match. He could do all the things that he used to do, but he did say that he first gained or started to gain weight after working the match with Kenny Omega a few years ago at the Tokyo Dome. And he started working with a weight loss clinic, and at first he just wanted to lose 10 pounds. He lost 11 pounds in the first week. And he saw that and he thought, well, let's stick with this and see how it goes. And today he is down to 209 pounds. He has lost 32 pounds since January, and most of that came between January and April. He's still on the blood thinners. He takes them twice a day. He says there's a chance, he's been told, that if things keep moving in the right direction, he might not have to be on them at all. But he said it was a wake-up call, that he needed to take better care of himself, and now he feels like he's having this career resurgence. You know, the weight loss was definitely noticeable when he came back in February. He looks much better, much healthier than he did last year. So does John Moxley. You know, before Moxley checked himself into rehab and ditched the booze, I mean, go back and look at photos of John Moxley before he went away for those few months. Just his face alone. How puffy and bloated. That was from all the alcohol. You know, I'm sure it was the same with Jericho. You know Jericho's got Grey Goose running through his veins. You cut him open, you're going to be able to pour glasses of Grey Goose. I'm sure that had a lot to do with all the weight that he gained too. When Moxley came back, I remember I said, look, it's Dean Ambrose. Where's he been? He looks so much better. So let this be a lesson. You got to take care of yourself. You know, when I... Look, I'll share a personal story here. You guys know if you've been listening to the podcast for a long time, I haven't really talked about this much recently, but I did at the time. You know, when I got my blood cancer diagnosis 6 years ago, I was scared shitless. And I was lucky because it wasn't anything serious enough that I needed, you know, chemo right away or any sort of immediate treatment, but it scared me because my mother had leukemia. And don't think that it's not on my mind that I'm only 4 years away from being the same age that she was when she was first diagnosed. I think about that a lot. But I hear the words blood cancer, and that's the first thing I thought of. But thankfully, I take a baby aspirin every day, and I get my blood checked every couple of months. And for the time being, that's really all that I need to do. I know at some point that's going to change, and we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. But that was my wake-up call. You know, I remember when the pandemic first started and I said, I'm not going to sit around. I'm not going to put on 20 pounds, but the gyms were closed. So that didn't help. But you got to take care of yourself. That's very important. You know, I dropped 30 pounds in 12 months without using a single piece of gym equipment. A lot of it a lot of it does just come down to what you eat. You can't outrun a shitty diet. It's true. I'm still learning that. But anyway, the Jericho stuff made me think of that, and maybe somebody hears this and it makes them stop and think about taking their own health a little more seriously. Kathy Carino, the former Allison Danger, who was among a handful of staff cuts at the WWE Performance Center earlier this year, she spoke out this week about her release on the most recent episode of Renee Paquette's podcast, The Sessions. I like how she quietly turned it from oral sessions to just The Sessions. I guess when you start to get big enough, I guess you got to clean it up a little bit. But Allison Danger, best known for her time in Ring of Honor and with Shimmer, the all-women's promotion she helped start with Dave Prazak, co-founders. She was hired as a full-time coach at the PC last October. She then moved her family cross-country from Las Vegas to Orlando, only to be released 3 months later. Not even a full 90 days, and they fired her. This was probably the scummiest of all of the many WWE releases, even though it's the one that got the least attention because she wasn't a major player in the company. And now to hear her tell her story in her own words is even more shameful. She told Renee to only be there 3 months and then to have it all blow up. I have a lot of mom guilt attached to it. I feel like I blew up my family and have nothing to show for it. That's brutal. That is absolutely brutal. And on the impact that it has had on her daughter, Kendall Grace, she said, it's not like Kendall's little. Kendall is 13 now, was 12 when all this went down, has only known Vegas. All her friends are in Vegas. All of a sudden, we're moving to Florida, and you've got to go to a new school and whatnot. It's been rough. It's been really difficult. She talked about her limited time in WWE in glowing terms. She said, even on a bad day, I loved it. Every morning I would show up, and before I walked through those doors, I would tell myself, or I would tell Steve, if we were having a cup of coffee, I get to come to work today. Not I have to come to work, but I get to come to work. Steve, by the way, for those who don't know, I'm sure most of you do. Steve is Steve Carino, her brother. He does still work for the at the Performance Center. He works for WWE. He was one of the few. He was one of the few of that inner circle, him and Shawn Michaels, who did not get let go. He's still there. But the day that she got the news that she was being let go just so happened to be Kendall's first day at school. And she was picking Kendall up from school when she got the call. She said, "It's my kid's first day at this brand new school in Orlando. They've never ridden a bus before because KG went to a charter school in Vegas. Never ridden a bus. Nervous that they're going to get off in the wrong neighborhood. I was picking KG up and we were going to go out to go have a special dinner to celebrate the very first day at a new school. And my phone rings. They said it wasn't my fault. There was nothing I did wrong. I literally got a text a couple of days before this that they, all of us were doing great jobs and how happy they were with the current roster. I was told that if they could bring me back, they would in a heartbeat and to make sure that I know it was not a reflection on me, it was a change from the higher-ups." And she talked about how she and her family are still dealing with the impact of her release. She said, "I feel like I got brought to Florida and then left to die. Because now my family is split. We're struggling through that. I'm still now 5 months out. I have nothing to show for it. And I still have no idea what I'm going to do. This has been a rock bottom year." Her husband had taken a job in South Carolina, which is what she means when she talks about her family being split. They're all over the place. They haven't been together because of all this in months. So that just makes it even harder. But she says that she hasn't received any offers yet from other companies, although I did just see a few days ago that she's going to be working for the Women's Wrestling Army promotion out of Chicago that was co-founded by Maria Kanellis and Bobby Cruz. She said, "There hasn't been phone calls. I feel like everybody landed on their feet but me. It's to the point where I'm like, is the universe telling me that this is it? That this is done? I chased the dream. I got it for 3 months. And I'm financially devastated. I'm emotionally like, what am I doing? And now I'm going, is this it for me? I have no idea what the future holds. If I weren't a mom, it wouldn't be so bad. But what happens to me also happens to my kid." You know, look, there's an old expression, last one hired, first one fired. WWE is not the only place that sort of thing happens. But what makes it so much worse is that she had to ship her entire family cross-country like that and uproot their lives, only to lose her job through no fault of her own, right? She gets a text message, "You didn't do anything wrong, you were doing great, oh, we would have you back in a heartbeat, but, you know, it came from the higher-ups, nothing we can do." That's the shittiest possible thing that you could hear, right? "Come move across the country, we're going to bring you in, we're going to hire you, we'll give you a little taste, and then we're going to fire you. But we're going to tell you that it's not your fault. You did nothing wrong." And then you're just kind of left there and wondering, what am I supposed to do now? She had to know something like that might happen because when they hired her, they had already had mass layoffs and furloughs at the height of the pandemic. They had gotten rid of so many people even before they hired her. I mean, this is a company that will not blink an eye to get rid of you. She had to know that she was taking a risk in doing that, but I mean, that doesn't make it any less scummy, what they did to her, especially at a time when this company, you know, again, making more money than it ever has before. You know this woman's situation. Keeping her on was not going to hurt them, was not going to hurt their bottom line, but they just don't care. And honestly, I doubt the higher-ups that they spoke of in that text message she talked about, I doubt the higher-ups even knew about any of that. They probably got a list of names. They said, "Kathy who? Allison who?" And then they just threw her name in the pile. Just a cog in the wheel. But a very sad story, you know, that she went through all that. And like she says, she feels now like she's got nothing to show for it. And she has no idea where she's going to land and what she's going to do. I mentioned I had some New Japan news. New Japan held a press conference on Thursday to discuss their business strategy and plans for the remainder of this year. The big news coming out of it is that moving forward, we are going to be seeing wrestlers from Stardom, which I would have to say is the top women's promotion in the world. I mean, name another one that's bigger or doing as well right now as Stardom. We're going to be seeing wrestlers from Stardom appearing in New Japan rings here in the U.S. I take that to mean New Japan Strong, but I don't think that that's what they said. I think they just said New Japan USA. Stardom and New Japan are owned by the same parent company. Bushiroad is the parent of both companies. Stardom wrestlers have appeared on New Japan events before. This year's Wrestle Kingdom, I think it was Night 2. It's the first time that a Stardom match aired on the main card. I think the year before, maybe it was a dark match. For the first time this year, they had an actual Stardom match on the main Wrestle Kingdom card. But they said that there's going to be a joint event between New Japan and Stardom in Tokyo on November 20th. They said the event will see a pair of mixed tag team matches between New Japan and Stardom talent, with men facing men and women facing women like they do in WWE. They said Stardom has exploded in growth. They noted that a few years ago, Stardom's annual revenue was less than $2 million, and they couldn't afford big contracts. In the last 2.5 years, Stardom revenue has increased 500%. Profits are way up, and they are the most popular Bushiroad company on YouTube. And they believe a crossover with New Japan will only help growth. Soon, they said, much like it is overseas, the Japanese scene will be genderless and more integrated. And there's even more Stardom news, because per Dave Meltzer, there has been communication between Stardom and AEW about a potential working relationship. And so there's no agreement yet, but he was told to expect some news very soon about that. Meltzer noted that Stardom is interested in having some AEW talents work for them, including Toni Storm, which is very cool. So, hey, Sasha Banks may be able to get the best of both worlds if she ends up going to AEW. She could end up working for Stardom, too. But they did announce other stuff as well. Cheering. This has been something, I've mentioned it a few times here on the podcast. Fans in Japan, or at least at the New Japan shows, it's been 2 years since fans have been allowed to cheer and boo and make noise at New Japan shows. All they can do right now is clap. That's because that's the way they're handling the COVID situation over in Japan. They don't want people cheering and booing and yelling and screaming and spreading particles, I guess, of the virus. And so that was their way of trying to mitigate that, banning noise and saying you can clap, but you can't cheer. It's been 2 years of this. They announced that there will be special sections set up with social distancing to allow cheering at events on September 5th and September 6th. So we have the G1 climax that's about to kick off. I think next week is the beginning of the G1. That's going to run through the beginning of August. So anybody who is hoping to have cheering back by then, they will not. But they have these events on September 5th and 6th. And during the press conference, it was announced that the company is going to hold those events at Corican Hall as part of their Burning Spirit tour. These shows will be at half capacity to allow for a cheering section. So it's a step, I guess. It's a first step, but it sounds like it's still going to be a while before things go back to normal as far as the live crowds are concerned. There's also been an update, not from the press conference, but there was an update this week on Kota Ibushi. And I talked about it, was about a month and a half ago, all that drama that went down with the translated tweets on social media and New Japan. I mean, there was some real bad blood there going on, and mostly from the Ibushi side, but New Japan had to make an announcement about it. I think they had a press conference, actually, to address some of the allegations that he made, and it was a whole big thing. Ibushi has not wrestled the match since the finals of the G1 last year in October. He was in the main event in the finals against Okada, and I think it might have been a Phoenix Splash. Landed on his shoulder and injured his shoulder. And he recently took to Twitter to reply to fans and do some Q&A. And he noted that, unfortunately, his shoulder is actually getting worse. So these are some of the translations of Ibushi's tweets from someone at the handle The Feel ITE. Says, sadly, my shoulder is getting worse. I have done my rehab according to the instructions and guidance of my doctors and trainers. I am not risking anything this time. My shoulder won't move at all, so I probably overdid it for many years. However, physically, it's been 8 months and I still can't do a single push-up. You can't worry about injuries as a wrestler. It is a profession that assumes injuries are going to happen. I won't forget that there are a lot of other people who have had more frustrations than me. If I wrestled now, my shoulder would dislocate in less than a minute. I'm sorry that it's gotten worse and made my daily life difficult, instead of having rested again for a little under a year. I will do everything I can to take care of my mother. For those who don't know, his mother had tried to commit suicide while Ibushi was having his very public meltdown a while back with New Japan. And that only added to the frustrations that he had with the company that his mother tried to take her life. He noted that the relationship with him in New Japan is still strained. He specifically mentioned the fact that the company had announced him for the New Japan Cup when they knew he would not be ready to come back by then. He said they announced it knowing that having me return by March 1st was impossible. A scam. So that is the latest from Kota Ibushi. I believe Ibushi, I think he declined to have surgery for his shoulder after it was suggested to him. So he's been trying to rehab it naturally for 8 months. And it's actually worse now than it was at the beginning. The fact that he can't even do a single push-up is not good. I don't know why he didn't just get the surgery done. I don't know why he's so resistant to the surgery or getting surgery, whatever the injury, the exact injury is. But for whatever reason, he doesn't want to. And so here we are. And, you know, if he insists on just not getting surgery for whatever reason, it's a very real possibility his shoulder may never heal. Which is a real shame, you know, one of the top stars in the company. He's not getting any younger. I think he's 40, or he just turned 40. It's not like he's a young man. I think there's got to be a lot of questions now about the future of Kota Ibushi in the ring. And a couple of social media notes here before we break into some Raw stuff, and I'll talk about the Angelo Dawkins interview. Shotzi Blackheart was in the news this week because Shotzi, after the Money in the Bank pay-per-view last weekend, took to Twitter to respond to critics of the women's Money in the Bank ladder match and her own performance, which was criticized. And this was the message that she posted. She said, "There are three things I care about at the end of a match. Is everybody safe? Did everybody have fun? And did the crowd react?" She said, "Nobody got hurt. We all had a blast. And the Vegas crowd was hot, hot, hot. I felt on top of the world after that match and was so excited to finally have my first hardcore match in over a year. I would not have done anything I did not practice or thought that I could not do safely. But I'm not a wrestling robot. I'm human and slips happen, especially in a chaotic, unpredictable ladder match. I can take a joke and laugh at myself. One of the first things I said was, I can't wait to see that spot on Botchamania. But comments like, you should be fired, and other terrible things admittedly hit hard. I had to have a few friends wipe the tears off my face and slap some sense into me and remind me who the F I am. That being said, all my haters can suck my big, giant, hairy mangoes." I think I may have to start using that as a quote. So here's the deal. You know, I reviewed Money in the Bank last weekend, and you know my thoughts on the women's Money in the Bank match. I didn't think it was very good. And there were a couple of different places where Shotzi tried something and she botched it and it didn't go well. But, you know, it wasn't like she ruined the match, right? I just didn't think the match, and certainly compared to the men's match at the end of the show, I just didn't think it was very good. And there's nothing wrong with having that opinion. What's wrong, or where it becomes wrong, is when you have people who are directing hatred at this woman. They're adding her, they're using her handle, or they're sending her private messages or whatever it might be, and saying some of the shit that these people were saying. So what ended up happening is she deactivated her Twitter account, which I think is still deactivated. And she'll come back. Everybody always does. I think you got 30 days. If you don't reactivate it, then they delete the whole thing. So she'll be back. But she deactivated her account because just the messages that she was getting and all the hate, it was just so overwhelming. The very next day is when she did that. And she ended up taking to Instagram to provide an update to all of her followers. She said, I appreciate everybody checking on me. I swear I'm fine. I have been going through the toughest year of my personal life, so it's deeper than nasty comments. But also, Twitter has not helped with my fragile mind state. Just trying to stay motivated and positive, I am focused on my own goals and not what is on the internet. So when she talks about having a tough year personally, she lost her father back in January after a battle with COVID. She's had some things go on in her personal life that are bigger and more important than just wrestling that have affected her. I think I mentioned that at the time, that her father had passed away. Social media is a cesspool. I think we can all agree on that. Most of us are on social media, right? Some of you aren't. Some of you aren't. I actually admire you people. But most of us are on social media. You're on Facebook, or you're on Twitter, or you're on YouTube is technically social media. You're on Instagram, you're on TikTok. There's so many different fucking apps and websites. Everybody's got a profile. Twitter in particular is probably the worst. It is an absolute cesspool. I get comments, although not nearly as bad as some of the comments that some of these wrestlers get and some of these women get. But I get comments, people get death threats, people, it's just horrible personal shit from people that don't even know you. Maybe they don't even follow you, but somehow they find you and they direct it at you, and it happens every day. You all see it on your timelines or in your replies. I know I do. So social media is an awful, terrible place. But it takes a special kind of person, I think. If you think that somebody is a bad wrestler, if you think that they have terrible matches, if you think this person, this guy, this girl, they're no good. I don't know what possesses a person to take time out of their day to actually punch that person's name in and send that message to them to make sure that they see it. If you go on your own Twitter page and say, so-and-so sucks and I don't think she's that good in the ring, there's nothing wrong with that. Because that's your opinion. You're well within your rights to go ahead and voice it. But it's the people that go, hey, at Shotzi, whatever her handle is, you suck and I think you should lose your job. That's the part about it that I never really understood. Now, I'm sure a lot of it has to do with those people being very deeply unhappy with their own lives. They probably have shit going on in their own lives, or they're lonely, or, you know, people don't like them. They're probably, you know, a terrible, shitty person. And so they project, right? Well, if I feel shitty, then I got to make sure everybody else feels just as shitty as I do. I'm sure a lot of it has to do with that. But still, I look at that and I go, what possesses, like, I would never, in my wildest imagination, I could say something on the podcast. If it's my opinion, I'm giving my opinion on somebody. It doesn't mean that when I'm done recording, or I'm done going live, you know what? I got to make sure this person sees what I said. And I'm going to go and I'm going to at them and say, hey, you suck, pal. What does that add to my day? Nothing. Nothing. But that's what you find on Twitter and on social media. They want to make sure you see it. They want to make sure that they can bring you down because obviously they have some kind of shitty, boring, terrible life of their own. And so I don't blame her. You know, sometimes the best thing to do is, frankly, to step away from social media. And the fact that she was driven to tears, you know, by these comments, I think I said this at the time when she died, the Hana Kimura story. And I remember making a comment, I don't know if it was on the podcast or to somebody in a tweet, ironically. I said, nothing is going to change. There's a lesson in there to be learned when it comes to bullying and just saying things about people and just being so brutal and so relentless about it that they actually are driven to take their own life. And it should be a learning experience. It should be something that people learn from, but it won't be. Same thing's going to happen. Clearly wrestling fans, in that case, it actually wasn't wrestling fans so much as it was people of that reality TV show that she was on. But clearly wrestling fans have not learned a lesson from this. That's probably the saddest part about the whole thing. Now, other times, there are people on social media who will post things just to set themselves up for negative feedback, which is what we got with Jordynne Grace this week. Jordynne Grace is the Impact Wrestling Knockouts champion. She made headlines this week with her tweets about Chris Benoit. in response to another tweet from somebody named Robert O'Neill, who wrote the following. He said, "It's always wild listening to wrestlers discuss Chris Benoit in a professional context because they always are sure to note they aren't excusing what happened before praising his in-ring stuff for 10 minutes. Except New Jack." And yes, if you never saw that New Jack rant, it's an all-timer. It's from the shoot interview with him and the Iron Sheik and the Honky Tonk Man. It's just, it's a murderer's row of crazy SOBs in one room. I think that's the same shoot where Honky and Sheik both pulled their pants down and mooned the camera, which is something I never needed to see. But New Jack just, he went the fuck off on Benoit for like 5 minutes straight. I mean, the other guys couldn't get a word in. And he just went off on Benoit, and rightfully so. He was also good friends with Nancy from the ECW days. So it was pretty clear that he was even angrier about what Benoit did because he knew her and he was probably friendly with her. But if I remember, though, as New Jack talked about Benoit burning in hell for what he did and how there's no excuse for him to kill his wife and son, he said this while he was sitting there wearing an O.J. Simpson jersey. Just amazing. That was a hell of a promo, though, from Smoky Mountain, for those who know about that. Anyway, that was the Robert O'Neill tweet. This was Jordan Grace's response. "This is going to be the coldest take I ever tweet on this app. I already know that you're all going to be mad. I don't think Benoit could 100% hang with most of the present-day best wrestlers. He would not be able to remember matches. Also, may he burn in hell. Amen." A fan then chimed in to ask her, "Removing the CTE, you don't think Benoit in his prime could keep up with the best of today? May I ask what the rationale behind that is?" And she said, "Maybe I'm biased because he murdered his family, I don't know. Probably just me. I think we should all hate him and disregard his entire body of work. But again, that's just my take. I always found it revolting to see people praise his wrestling after what he did." Gail Kim, also a former Knockouts champion, saw this and she chimed in. She said, "Controversial for sure. I disagree, though, with the take of hanging with the best of the best today. He most certainly could, and I saw someone comment Kurt Angle couldn't either. He would mop the floor with everybody." And Jordan Grace replied back by saying, "I just personally cannot separate the person from the wrestler." She has since deleted all of her tweets about Benoit because she was getting blasted for it. She knew that she would be. She said as much. I mean, she admitted it right at the beginning of that first tweet. So it's like, you know, dangling the bait. I don't know what else she expected. But, you know, I want to talk about this because I see both sides of this. Some people simply cannot talk about Benoit as a wrestler without immediately thinking of him as a child killer, which is what he is. He is a child murderer. He did not just brutally murder his wife, he smothered his own son. As posters of himself were hanging on his kid's wall. Everything about what he did is inexcusable. People still try to make excuses for it by saying, "Oh, it was this, and he had the brain of this, and this and that." He did what he did. Not the first time, by the way, there were stories about him being physically abusive, but we'll put that on the side. He did what he did, there's no excuse for it. And I don't fault people who can't talk about Benoit or they can't watch a Benoit match because all it does is remind them of the evil that he committed. I could talk about Benoit as a wrestler because a lot of times his old matches will come up or I get asked a question about it in the mailbag or something. And, you know, I don't have a problem talking about Benoit the wrestler. I can have a discussion as a normal human being and it doesn't bother me. I think that's fine. I don't go out of my way to watch old Chris Benoit. I didn't wake up one day and say, "Hey, you know what? I think today I'll go on a Chris Benoit binge." Like, I'm never going to do that again. I didn't do that before. I'm not going to do that now. But if I'm watching a show and there's a Chris Benoit match on there, if it's an old Nitro or an old pay-per-view or something, I don't fast forward through it. You know, if it's a interesting enough match, I can watch his matches and it doesn't bother me. It's fine. If you can't watch it, that's also fine. What she was addressing here was not what Benoit did to his family, though. She specifically was addressing his wrestling ability. And when you do that, it's fair game for people to blast you for saying something stupid. Again, not in an overly derogatory way where they wish death upon you or some of the shit that these fucking morons do on social media. And if you're one of those people, even if you disagree with what she said, if you came back at her and made fun of her looks or you say you should die or this or that, you're a fucking idiot. But the idea that Chris Benoit in the ring couldn't hang with the best wrestlers of today is pure nonsense. And I don't know who Gail Kim is referring to when she says that there may be some random moron on Twitter who had a similar take about Kurt Angle in his prime not being able to hang with the guys today. Whoever said that should have their social media privileges revoked immediately. Kurt Angle not only could go in any era, he would be as good or better than 95% of the best wrestlers that we have in the world today. And that's not even a knock on the best wrestlers of today. There's some really great ones out there. That's just how fucking great Kurt Angle was in his prime. The guy was a machine. Prime Kurt Angle in the ring was untouchable. He may be the greatest of all time. I liked prime Kurt Angle more than I did prime Chris Benoit. But to say that Benoit couldn't hang with the best, you know, part of the problem is that wrestling has changed so much. Everybody feels the need now to do dives in every match, and they do all these crazy moves and these... It's spots, right? It's like crazy spot fest. Benoit didn't have to do that stuff. I mean, he did do the diving headbutt off the top, and he could do a tope every now and then. I remember the crazy one on SmackDown with Booker T where he just went flying into the side of the announce desk. But that's not the kind of wrestler Benoit generally was. You know, she says he wouldn't be able to remember matches, and that's part of why he couldn't hang with all these guys. She's not talking about CTE or anything. She's saying he wouldn't be able to remember all the stuff that he would do and keep up with these guys. He wouldn't be able to remember spots. That's a big difference between wrestling then and wrestling now. Now, they need to remember all the spots that they want to do because there's so many of them. You know, this wasn't Randy Savage and Ricky Steamboat at WrestleMania 3. Where Savage had everything literally on paper, mapped out move for move, because he wanted to make sure this match was going to be the best match possible, right? That was rare. I don't think there were too many people who were doing that back then. Back then, you came up with a few things that you wanted to do, you knew the finish, you got in the ring, and you called it on the fly. You didn't worry about remembering every little fucking thing that you had to do. You went out, and you did it. It came naturally. You were able to call it live. And to me, that's a lot more impressive than trying to remember every little spot that you've come up with and every big move that you need to kick out of 5,000 times. That wasn't the burn I think that she intended it to be. It was actually an indictment on how wrestling has changed relative to how it used to be. Guys like Benoit and Kurt Angle, they would go in there and they would work real. It looked more realistic and stiff, and it looked more like a real fight than a lot of the matches that we see today. Me, personally, as a fan, I don't judge how good a match is based on how many rotations somebody got on their 650. Or how many super kicks they can throw, or how many destroyers they can hit on the apron. I see a lot of matches that have a lot of super kicks and destroyers and stuff, and they can be great fucking matches. But to me, it's not just that that dictates, well, instead of a four-star match, he did the extra flip, and so I gotta give him the five. Like, that's not how I judge wrestling as a fan. Those matches can be great too, but today it's more of a performance. Whereas back then, I mean, they were still performing, but it felt like they were at least trying to make you forget that it was a performance, even just for a few minutes, and make it feel like more of a real struggle, like a real fight, a real battle. So since she brought up his wrestling skills, I think it's absolutely fair game to talk about all this. None of what I just said is meant to praise Chris Benoit. He was a piece of shit for what he did, and his legacy is forever stained. But to say that he wouldn't be able to hang with the best that we see in the ring today, had he not done what he did to his wife and kid, let's say that Benoit was working as a trainer, or a coach, or running his own wrestling school, which supposedly he was thinking of doing right before, you know, he went on his murderous binge. If he was a trainer, if he had a school, he would have a line out the fucking door of people waiting to learn from him how to be a professional wrestler. I doubt very much that Jordan Grace or anybody else would be making that kind of comment today, were it not for what he did. But as she said, she can't separate the two. I understand that. I understand the hatred. He was a monster. On that, we can agree. But I still think if you honestly believe that he and guys like him at that level couldn't hang with the best of the best today, that is a very stupid take. Raw last Monday was a 4th of July holiday episode, and we had Otis projectile vomiting after his match because he ate too many hot dogs. In case you were wondering whether Vince McMahon was still in charge of creative, now you know. Apparently, the original plan was that Otis would vomit on Chad Gable's boots, but they settled on doing it the other way. These are the important decisions that are made in these WWE creative meetings. We didn't have to wait long to find out that John Cena will not be at SummerSlam this year. Remember, I had said that by tomorrow we would have our answer. I said by the July 11th episode of Raw, if they have not even teased a direction for Cena at SummerSlam, or just flat out announced that he would be at SummerSlam, then he wasn't going to be there. We didn't even have to wait for tomorrow. In the opening segment, Austin Theory interrupted Bobby Lashley. He said that he was challenging him to a rematch for the United States Championship at SummerSlam, and that he would win back the title and then cash in his Money in the Bank contract on whoever the last man standing was in the main event between Brock Lesnar and Roman Reigns, which he made it a point to say would be their last ever match. That's like me beating up my little brother when I was younger and promising that it would never happen again. I was full of shit then, and they are full of shit now. But there was no mention of John Cena at all, so it's pretty clear that if they did have some hope or plan for him to be at SummerSlam, that is no longer going to happen. They were in San Diego. So Rey and Dominic Mysterio, they were over huge for their match against Finn Balor and Damian Priest. Balor is now wearing long pants for the first time that I can remember. Didn't bring him any good luck. Didn't bring him any better luck than he's been having on the main roster. It was not a good night for the Judgment Day. Priest slid a chair to Balor in the ring. Rey saw the chair and did the Eddie Guerrero spot where he took a phantom bump so that when the referee turned around, it looked like Balor hit him with the chair. And Balor got disqualified. Balor already proving to be an inferior leader as compared to Edge. But this was not a burial of the Judgment Day or some terrible loss from which there is no return. It was a tribute spot. It popped the crowd in Rey's hometown. You know, a rare hometown babyface win in this company. How many times do we see that? The people loved the finish live. They reacted huge to it. And then later in the show, Balor and Priest got their heat back by attacking Rey and Dominic in the back. So I'm not going to write this thing off just yet. It's unfortunate that Rhea Ripley got hurt when she did. She should be feuding with Bianca Belair right now for the Raw Women's Championship. Now it looks like they're going to run things back, possibly at SummerSlam with Bianca and Carmella again. You know, ditching Edge didn't bother me because I thought he was just fucking boring with those promos, but they ditched their leader, and I think within a week or two of them ditching Edge on TV, they ended up wrestling on Main Event. And that's never a good sign. If they can get Rhea back and get her back into the title hunt, and when Edge comes back, if he puts over Priest or he puts over Balor, then there's still life there. But if Edge comes back and just beats them, I think it's pretty much game over for them. You know, Vince McMahon just does not see Finn Balor as a main event player. You know, certainly not one capable of being on Edge's level. And I'm not even sure when they're getting Rhea back. She just tweeted a photo of her yesterday wearing what appears to be a heart monitor on her chest. So it looks like she may be dealing with something a little more serious than we thought. All of a sudden, the women's title doesn't seem so important. Miz did his best fake tough guy impression when addressing Logan Paul's comments about kicking his ass at SummerSlam. Miz still wants the two of them to go after the tag team titles, but if Logan doesn't agree, he threatened to be relentless. I'm sure Logan Paul is just soiling himself in fear over the thought of Miz coming after him. Later in the show, Miz wrestled AJ Styles again. Styles picked up the win this time, but then was immediately ambushed by Tommaso Ciampa. Styles was fighting him off when Miz snuck up and dropped him with a skull-crushing finale, and then Miz and Ciampa shook hands, finally acknowledging all these random attacks that have not been so random. Miz and Ciampa have a working agreement together. They have a mutual respect. The Tommaso Ciampa of NXT would not be caught dead joining forces with someone like The Miz. But this is clearly not the Tommaso Ciampa of NXT. So instead of a singles match at SummerSlam with Miz and Logan Paul, which it could still be, it looks like maybe they might be setting up for a tag team match with Miz and Ciampa against AJ and Logan Paul. That would be their way maybe of trying to get Logan Paul cheered by pairing him up with somebody the fans actually like. Nice try. But I still don't think it's going to work. You know, the reason Logan Paul got dropped by Miz at WrestleMania at the end of their match was because he wanted to end his run as a babyface. That was said to be a Logan Paul request. And that was their way of doing that, even though the fans cheered Miz like he was fucking Michael Jordan sinking the game-winning shot for the Bulls 25 years ago. That's how much of a babyface the fans took Logan Paul to be at the end of that match at WrestleMania. Pairing him up with AJ Styles would not be the worst idea in the world, though, you know, for another reason. The man just signed his contract. He has never wrestled a singles match a day in his life. Putting him in a tag team match for the first time, you know, back would be the better play. And I know some people are going to be upset if they do that because, oh, what a waste of AJ Styles. I mean, what do you expect AJ to be doing if he's not tagging with Logan Paul? The only possible other match for him that they have even hinted at would be a singles match with Ciampa. I think they're more likely to give that away on TV before SummerSlam. You know, if not for this, it's not as if there's another program set up for him. This is it. This is it for AJ Styles right now. So if you want him on the SummerSlam card, I think this is going to be your best bet. It's not about AJ Styles to Vince McMahon and Bruce Pritchard. It's not about AJ Styles. It's damn sure not about Tommaso Ciampa. This is all about Logan Paul. And getting Logan Paul over. Right, I talked about this in my celebrity segment last week. It's no longer about the celebrities giving the rub to the talent. It's about the talent being there to play second fiddle and make the celebrity look good. And if they do that tag team match, you know damn well that Ciampa is probably there for one reason and one reason only, and that's to eat the pin. That way, they still get to do their singles match later on with Miz and Logan Paul. Ciampa is just a means to an end. Liv Morgan made her final appearance on Monday Night Raw as she has officially been moved to the SmackDown roster now that she is the SmackDown Women's Champion. Actually, I guess I shouldn't even assume that. They had fucking Walter on this show for no apparent reason, even though he's a champion on SmackDown. They had him destroy R-Truth, who was dressed up as Uncle Sam. They don't even pretend that there's an actual brand split anymore. So we'll probably see more of Liv Morgan on Raw. Hell, we might see her back on Raw tomorrow night. But this was her first promo since cashing in her Money in the Bank to beat Ronda Rousey. The story that's out there is that Ronda Rousey personally demanded, she personally lobbied for Liv Morgan to beat her to win the SmackDown Women's title because she felt that she deserved it. Ronda's personal photographer, this guy Michael Mardonis, claimed on Instagram that Ronda never wanted or asked to be champion. And she demanded that the most passionate pro wrestler be awarded the most prestigious title in our industry. That's very nice of Ronda to demand that Jay White win the IWGP heavyweight title. I guess we know who to thank for that now. I'm not sure what that has to do with Liv Morgan, though. But that is the story. That is what Ronda supposedly said and pushed for it to happen, and WWE wasn't even planning on having Liv Morgan win Money in the Bank in the first place. I mean, if you've been watching the television going back to late last year, it seemed pretty clear that they had no real plans for Liv Morgan to win any championship. And her win at Money in the Bank felt like it came out of nowhere, so I can buy that, I can believe that. She thanked the fans for sticking with her and used words like we and us when talking about winning the title. She screamed a lot. It wasn't a bad promo, but she sort of shouted her way through it. She was just really overexcited. At least she was excited about being the champion. At least you could tell that it meant a lot to her. And then she was interrupted by Natty. And then Carmella. And it turned into your typical formula WWE segment. This led to the two champions, Bianca and Liv, tagging against Natty and Carmella. with Liv winning the match for their team. I don't see Liv Morgan spending a whole lot of time, you know, with that championship around her waist. And I think that the only way she gets out of SummerSlam, the only way she gets out of the month of July with that championship, is if she wrestles Ronda Rousey, which she's going to. It is now official for SummerSlam. It'll be Ronda Rousey, a fresh Ronda Rousey, one-on-one with Liv Morgan. Then Charlotte Flair returns, and she costs Ronda the match. And that would be the only way that I could see Liv Morgan surviving into another month with that SmackDown Women's title. And by the way, once Charlotte comes back, Liv's on borrowed time with that title anyway. We had these constant cut-ins back to the big 4th of July bash from earlier in the day, which looked like it was filmed under a tent outside of the parking lot. Mustafa Ali and Cedric Alexander, they stole Veer's plate of food and he went after them. The brigade of 24/7 geeks chased after Dana Brooke. Reggie accidentally plowed into Omos, who chucked him off camera. And then we had Ezekiel accidentally spraying ketchup on Seth Rollins off camera. Seth walked into the camera shot and we saw ketchup all over him. That's when Ezekiel went to go put ketchup on his hot dog. Let me pause right there. First of all, who puts ketchup on their hot dog? Mustard belongs on a hot dog. Mustard, sauerkraut. I would even excuse relish if you're into relish. You don't put ketchup on a hot dog. You know what I used to dip my hot dog into ketchup when I was fucking 5 years old? You don't put ketchup on a hot dog. It's one of the only things that disgusted Clint Eastwood in all the Dirty Harry movies, and for good reason. So he sprayed it all over Seth's shirt, and this led to a match. Like Jericho spilling coffee on Kane. Rollins won with the stomp in a match that just reeked of trying to kill time. And Matt Riddle laid out Rollins after the match with an RKO out of nowhere, and so that looks to be another match for SummerSlam. I know the two of them have been doing a lot of main events on some of the house shows. Back at the 4th of July party earlier in the day, they had a hot dog eating contest. Otis wolfed down, I think they said, 23 hot dogs and beat out Angelo Dawkins, but Tozawa beat them both. We didn't actually see him eating any of them, but they kind of panned over to him and they announced him as the winner and they claimed he, I think, 48 hot dogs is what he ate. I'm sure not a single one of them with ketchup on it. Otis was holding his stomach. He didn't feel well. So you knew where this was headed. You knew exactly where this was headed. They had a six-man tag team match with Lashley and the Street Profits taking on Theory and the Alpha Academy. I like Lashley and Montez Ford doing stereo delayed vertical suplexes while flexing their one free arm. I thought that was cool. Lashley ended up pinning Chad Gable off a spear. And after the match, Otis, he's holding his guts. He's holding his stomach. And all of a sudden, he pukes his guts up. And they showed a replay of it in slow motion. And then they wanted to zoom in on it on the mat, but there really wasn't a lot of it there. There was like one little chunk, it looked like a giant pea, and so they tried to zoom in on that, because of course they did. It's a time-honored tradition in this company, going back to Papa Shango putting a voodoo curse on the Ultimate Warrior and having him throw up pea soup. Right? Remember Booker T puking all over Michael Cole? Seth Rollins puking after he took Rey Mysterio's eye out at the Performance Center during the horror show at Extreme Rules. We had some fun with that on the YouTube channel that night, didn't we? But on the subject of the Street Profits, I mentioned Angelo Dawkins. He was in the hot dog eating contest. Coming off probably the greatest match of his career. I can't think of a better one that I've seen him be part of. Him and Montez Ford against the Usos and Money in the Bank last weekend. Angelo Dawkins was the guest of Corey Graves on his After the Bell podcast. And he acknowledged all of the talk, all the chatter about his partner possibly becoming a single star, as well as all of the praise that Montez Ford has been getting. He said, "I'd be lying if I said I didn't hear all the talk on the internet all the time about Tez. Tez is a freak of nature. That's my brother. I know he's good. I know he's talented. He's destined to become the world champion. But then on the other hand, I saw people talking about me like I'm some scrub or whatever. That took me back to when I first started. When I first started, people were talking like I wasn't even going to make it a month. I was like, oh, all right, we'll see. Now everybody is talking about me in that kind of way, saying that, you know, I'm like second fiddle, like I'm just the other guy or whatever. I remember after SmackDown, we landed from Phoenix, landed in Vegas. I got to the hotel, and it was just in my head and stuff. It was pissing me off to a degree, like, you know me, I'm a quiet guy. I'll joke around, but I try not to let a lot of things get to me. That was getting to me. I just remember I went on a long walk down the strip. I walked just to clear my head. I never really liked to go walking anyway, but I needed to clear my head. Everybody thinks for some weird reason that I'm not good. I'm very unselfish. I do whatever I can to make the match great. Tez is obviously the more out there guy, so I don't mind being in the background. I star in my role. I'll play my role. I'm a role player in a way, but then I had to remind everybody, like, hey, you're going to have to put some respect on my name. The talk is starting to piss me off now. Now you're about to see a different me. What a great setup for a heel turn, huh? That's my first thought. Look, if I'm Angelo Dawkins, a heel turn is the last thing that I want. I want to keep this team together, if I'm him, as long as possible, because the minute they split, I don't think it's going to end well for him. This is a Sean and Marty type of deal, and Dawkins is not Shawn Michaels. He's not going to be the Sean in this equation. He impressed a lot of people at Money in the Bank last weekend, including me. He was showing off moves that I've never seen him do before, and if I were him, I would be pissed off too. He has every right to be upset. I would use that as extra motivation to make people eat their words and stick it down their throat, but it doesn't change the fact that Montez Ford is a future world champion in this company. Angelo Dawkins is not. Just like Shawn Michaels was a future world champion, Marty Jannetty was not. Bret Hart was a future world champion, Jim Neidhart was not. Scott Steiner was a future world champion, Rick Steiner was not. There are rare exceptions to that. Edge and Christian ended up going on both to have pretty damn good careers, Matt and Jeff Hardy. Although, again, in WWE, it was never about Matt Hardy. It was always Jeff who got the big push. This is just, it feels to me like another one of these situations. Montez Ford has it. Whatever it is, however you define it, he's got it. When I say Montez Ford is going to be a star, it's not meant as a knock on Angelo Dawkins, like he sucks or something like that, but you don't have to be a psychic to see who's going to be the one getting all the attention. So I know it bothers him. And he's got every right to be annoyed by that, and it must feel like Final Destination to him, like one of the Final Destination movies where no matter what he does, he's running away from a fate that just feels like it's inevitable. But, you know, I know this company. I've been watching this company for so many years. It's so clear where this is headed. I can understand why he would be annoyed by that. But like I said, he had the performance of a lifetime, the best performance of his career last weekend. He keeps churning out matches like that, and maybe he'll turn some heads. They closed out the show with another Becky Lynch against Asuka match. This time it was no holds bar. That gave them toys to play with. Becky won with a manhandle slam off the middle rope through a table. Corey Graves welcomed her back to the big time like her big slump was finally over. You know, I understand there have been injuries. I understand they were handicapped by Sasha and Naomi walking out. Things happened that changed some of their plans. And that probably is why it feels like we've seen Becky against Asuka so much, because we have. I don't need to see them fight ever again. It's time to move on. But Becky Lynch should not come anywhere near Bianca Belair. Not before Bianca faces Rhea Ripley. So, who does that leave for Becky Lynch? You know, she needs to be done with Asuka. Liv Morgan is now on SmackDown. That leaves Alexa Bliss, Nikki Ash, Doudrop, and Tamina. Not a very inspiring menu of options. I mean, Alexa would be the best option of all those. I mean, I look at some of the other names outside of Alexa. I mean, this is not a very appetizing menu of options here. They could move somebody over from SmackDown since SmackDown got Liv. It makes you wonder why they ever moved Lacey Evans back to Fridays in the first place. There's also Bayley. Bayley should be back shortly. We just don't know which brand she's going to end up on. Boy, you know, I'm looking at the lay of the land here. They really could use Sasha Banks and Naomi right about now. And Brock Lesnar is going to be back on TV tomorrow night. And I talked about this on the SmackDown review. I'm not going to get into any SmackDown stuff here, but SmackDown was largely, just like I said, an abysmal show. But Paul Heyman, every now and then, even though a lot of his promos run together and they sound the same, he's been cutting the same promo largely now for years, still very good at it. But every now and then, Heyman will drop a little reminder to let you know why he is considered one of the best promos of all time. And I felt like Friday was one of those nights. He cut Roman Reigns' promo for him, and he cut Brock Lesnar's promo for him. He was putting Brock Lesnar over like he was still his advocate. He was trying to build up that last man standing match at the pay-per-view. Brock doesn't even have to be on the show. We know he's not going to wrestle. He doesn't need to come out and cut a promo. Heyman already did the job for him on Friday. I thought that was one of the best Paul Heyman promos in a very long time. So what Brock is going to be doing, I'll tell you what Brock is going to do. Brock's going to come out. He'll have his flannel. He'll have his cowboy hat. He'll get a big pop. He'll have a big smile on his face. Maybe he'll introduce himself the way that Heyman used to introduce him. And he'll talk about the last man standing match with Roman Reigns for about 60 seconds. And that'll be it. Maybe they'll send somebody out there that he can lay out with an F5, but I'm not even sure they'll go that far. So that's what you have to look forward to tomorrow night on Raw with Brock Lesnar. I am going to get into your mailbag questions here. I know the NXT had the Great American Bash this week. I did watch it, although I didn't get to finish it until late in the week. We do have new NXT Women's Tag Team Champions, though. Toxic Attraction lost their titles to Cora Jade and to Roxanne Perez. Yeah, they had a pretty decent match, I thought. That, I tell you what, the match I might have enjoyed the most, I enjoyed that Grayson Waller-Carmelo Hayes match for the North American Championship, where Hayes retained Bron Breakker. He retained his NXT Championship over Cameron Grimes. I don't know what the plan is now for Cameron Grimes, if he's getting called up, or what exactly the future holds for him. He's another one of these guys, and I felt this way about Gargano and Ciampa at the end of their run there, where it just feels like, you know, he's done all he can do. He was the heel. The fans turned him babyface. He peaked with that feud with LA Knight, and he won the $1 million title, and then he won the North American title, and now he just competed for the NXT championship, but he clearly is not in position to win that title. So where he goes from here, I don't know. But Bron Breakker got laid out by Jordan Devlin at the end of the show, who they have called up from NXT UK. Now he's going by the name JD McDonough. And he put Breakker through a table to end the show. So I guess that's going to be our next NXT championship match. I don't really have a whole lot else to say, honestly, about the Great American Bash and the other matches on the show. NXT is just sort of, it's kind of going along, and there's not a whole lot of exciting stuff really going on that show. But let's get to your questions. If you have them, email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Like James from Los Angeles, who says, my question is about Dustin Rhodes and if you feel he will go back to WWE before the end of the year. I say this as a fan of the Goldust gimmick and me feeling that it makes sense to put that character in the 2023 Hall of Fame, given that it's taking place in LA and he was billed from there. Well, this is a stretch now, though. This is a stretch, but he says, if he doesn't come back, should WWE make a deal with AEW for one appearance? In exchange, they lend someone like Seth or Kevin Owens for the Ring of Honor Hall of Fame. Well, that's not going to happen. No, I don't think. The fact that Goldust, the character, was billed for, first of all, it was billed from Hollywood, specifically. I don't think anybody cares about that. I mean, Dustin Rhodes is a Texas guy, and if it was going to matter where you put him in the Hall of Fame, you would do it in Texas. And I think one day he will be in the WWE Hall of Fame. But there's no great rush, I think, to put him in now where they have to try to strike a deal. Like some kind of a talent exchange with WWE. Absolutely not going to happen. Nor do I think he needs to be in the 2023 class. Is Dustin going there before the end of the year? No. He has made it very clear. He is very happy in AEW. He's also doing stuff behind the scenes with the women. I know he wished Cody all the best, and he was very upset when Cody left because he enjoyed working with his brother, but Dustin does not seem to have any immediate interest whatsoever in going back to WWE. He is very happy in AEW. Tim from Texas, speaking of Texas, how would you feel if WWE got rid of the Money in the Bank pay-per-view and have the matches instead at WrestleMania, where you can have the women have their match on night one and the men could have their match on night two or vice versa? What are your thoughts? Yeah, I wish that Money in the Bank would have stayed, frankly, a WrestleMania concept. I think the genie's out of the bottle, though, at this point. I don't think you can unring that bell. You know, they've established now for many years that it's its own pay-per-view. It's been, how many years has it been? I mean, it's been at least a decade. I think it's been maybe 11 or 12 years now of these actual Money in the Bank pay-per-views. I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, you could do, like you said, you could separate them out, women on night one, men on night two, or men on night one, women on night two. I just don't think it's realistic to expect that they're going to get rid of the pay-per-view. I mean, they were going to try to have Money in the Bank in a stadium. They thought they could get 30 or 40,000 people in Allegiant Stadium for Money in the Bank. And that was a big miscalculation on their part. But they think Money in the Bank is big enough where, you know, one day they can make it a stadium show. So they're not getting rid of it. Mark is from Dallas. Which wrestler or wrestlers who never won the Royal Rumble should have won one? Well, I mean, you got a few options there. The first name that pops into my head is Kurt Angle. I feel like Kurt Angle should have had a Royal Rumble win on his resume. He also in his email mentioned Eddie Guerrero. I don't think Eddie needed to win the Rumble. He mentions Jericho. Yeah, Jericho, maybe. Kurt Angle is the one that really stands out to me. I think Kurt Angle should have had a Royal Rumble win at some point in his career. So keep emailing me those questions. I just wanted to pull a few of them. Some of you I'll try to answer directly. But again, thesolemonster@gmail.com is always open, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. For those of you who are a channel member on YouTube, and if you are not, you might want to consider becoming one, because we did our Canadian Stampede 10-man tag in your house, live watch-along on Wednesday. We hung out for an hour. We watched the main event, the promo leading up to it, the entrances, the post-match chaos. It's been a while since I've gone back and watched the whole thing from start to finish. It was a lot of fun, and we're going to be doing more watch-alongs in the future, considering one for the 30th anniversary, in fact, at the end of next month, SummerSlam at Wembley Stadium. It's going to be 30 years since that Bret Hart British Bulldog match. So if you want access to all the past watch-alongs and the future ones that we do, and again, these are open to all channel members, regardless of which tier that you're on, just go to the YouTube channel. And on the channel main page or under any video, if you're not already a member, you'll probably see a join button, a white join button. I don't know if it's white or blue. Click that button. It'll give you all the details, and you can sign up and support the channel, and you'll have access to some special features, some special bonus content. And keep cashing in that Audible link. A lot of you have been downloading the John Moxley audiobook. John, in his own words, narrating the entire thing and going off on Kevin Dunn. Always a beautiful thing. Audibletrial.com/Solemonster. A lot of you have gotten two books because you're a Prime member. Apparently, Prime members, you can get two free books with that link instead of one. So get the Moxley book, get the Death of WCW, get the Nitro book by Guy Evans, the Daniel Bryan book, Bob Holly's book I think is still on there. That's a great one. Justin Roberts had a pretty good book. I mean, everything's on there. They've got one of Jericho's books, Hogan's book, if you want one with fiction and tall tales, that's on there. Stone Cold's old book, it's all on there. Audibletrial.com/Solemonster. I will be back with you live on YouTube on Wednesday for Dynamite, as I always am, but I'll be back here with you on the flagship, on the main show, next Sunday. That's going to be episode 765. Man, I can remember doing episode 65. I think that was a double-parter, too. That was my WrestleMania 25 review with my favorite WrestleMania match of all time. Eventually, the Legends members on YouTube will have access to that. It'll be a while before I get to uploading that, but episode 765, that's going to be coming up next Sunday. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. I'm sure there'll be plenty more news to dive into next week. So until then, take care, guys.
The Solemonster sounds off.
After the match, Shanky, he danced with Samantha Irvin at ringside. And Samantha Irvin has a big smile on her face, and she gets up and she starts dancing. Everybody's dancing. I wish they would take the writers of this show and they would take Vince and Bruce and lock them in a fucking room. Let Shanky book the show. It'll just be the dance-offs up and down the card. We'll have Walter. Let's have Gunther go out there and he can dance every match, right? We'll have the Usos dancing. We'll have Roman Reigns dancing. We'll have Riddle dancing. Pat McAfee's up on the announce desk. He's always dancing. Michael Cole Cole can dance, right? 25 years, let's have a celebration. He can start dancing around, right? The crowd will start dancing around. The referees will start dancing around. Adam Pearce can start dancing around. Max Dupree can start dancing around. It'll just be one big fucking dance fest. I don't even know what I was talking about.
The Solomonster sounds off each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
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 Solomonster sounds off.